What is up, you guys? Welcome to yet another edition of Controversial Thoughts. I have been wanting to make this exact video for a very long time. I want to talk about the importance of context. This came up on Joe Rogan's podcast. All of the show notes for that are at heartandsoil.co/Rogan. There are probably over 300 references there. We didn't get to talk about all of them on the show, but many of the things I did cover are there, plus lots of other points regarding different aspects of animal-based diets, evolutionary eating, and ancestral themes around eating. One of the biggest things that keeps coming up when I think about this is the importance of context. This is when you hear me talk about metabolic health and how critical metabolic health is for interpreting things like lipids, LDL, lipoprotein little a, but also things like uric acid and ApoE4, among others. So I want to touch on all of those briefly in this video and show you guys how context, that is whether an individual is metabolically healthy or unwell or has inflammation, all of these are sort of proxies for the same condition of underlying metabolic health, affects risk with many of these markers. Now, this I believe is what Western medicine misses time and time again. They don't think about context. We're not taught to think about context in medical school. We assume that all of the population is ill, which is a reasonable assumption when probably greater than 80% of the population is metabolically unwell. But most of us in this sphere who think about our health, who are doing carnivore or carnivore-ish diets or ketogenic diets or paleolithic diets, are not part of the 80 to 88% of the population that is metabolically unwell. We are metabolically healthy, but some of us get high levels of LDL. This is exactly what I talked about on Joe Rogan. As you saw me post on Twitter recently, in 2014, my LDL was 120 some. I'll show you guys my LDL from 2014. So this is a screenshot of my lipids from when I was in medical school at the University of Arizona. You can see here my LDL was 126. In 2014, my AST and ALT were normal. My total cholesterol was high because my HDL was 116 and my triglycerides were 45. So I do not have familial hypercholesterolemia. But what happened to my cholesterol? What happened to my LDL when I started eating more of an animal-based diet? When I cut out olive oil, when I cut out all plants, and essentially when I eliminated any excessive or any extra polyunsaturated fats in my diet. The saturated fat went up, my polyunsaturated fats went way down. I stopped taking any fish oils, really don't eat fish that much. My LDL went way up. It went to 300 milligrams per deciliter and then over 500 milligrams per deciliter in my most recent lipid panel. Now this came up on Rogan, it's caused a huge stir. I've talked about it before. This isn't the first time I've talked about it. It's why I got a coronary artery calcium scan, which is zero. So there's no calcified plaque in my heart arteries. The ticker is working good. Believe me, exercise every day. Don't get chest pain. Don't get angina. Don't have xanthoma or xanthelasma, which are typical skin manifestations that people with familial hypercholesterolemia get. So people with familial hypercholesterolemia, especially homozygous familial hypercholesterolemia, get levels of cholesterol on par with mine and develop xanthoma and xanthelasma very quickly. I don't have any of these manifestations. This is what xanthomas look like, kind of yellowish plaques on the eyelids or the hands or the legs or the arms underneath this part of the eye or the neck. So I don't have these, but children or adults with familial hypercholesterolemia do get these manifestations. So right there, we begin to have a suspicion that an elevated, quote, LDL on an animal-based diet is probably not the same as an elevated LDL related to familial hypercholesterolemia. I talked about this with Dave Feldman on a recent podcast. We know that many people with familial hypercholesterolemia have disordered lipid metabolism, meaning the way that the LDL particles are taken up at the LDL receptor is disordered, depending where in the LDL metabolic chain the actual defect is that results in familial hypercholesterolemia. Nevertheless, I don't have xanthelasma, I don't have xanthomas, I don't have familial hypercholesterolemia. So then the question becomes, will I or will you, if you have a similar response in your LDL eating what I believe is an ancestrally consistent diet, have accelerated atherosclerosis? I would argue no. Because so much of the research that has been done is in people who are metabolically unwell. Let's think about context. If you heard the podcast I did with Nadir Ali from yesterday, you will hear him talk about the fact that my labs, which I've talked about before, are good. My fasting insulin is low. My inflammation is low. My brain works reasonably well. I work out every day. I'm lean. I am not a metabolically unwell person. I don't have diabetes. I don't have metabolic dysfunction. My HDL is high. My triglycerides are low. This is not the constellation we see with people who have metabolic dyslipidemia. The context is different, right? So in this condition, in this situation, is LDL really going to be the same player in atherosclerosis that it appears to be in someone with diabetes or metabolic dyslipidemia? I would argue, no, it's not. The context matters. It is the ultimate determining factor, and I'll show you why. If you're not familiar, the terminology around lean mass hyper-responders, I'll show you a couple slides from my buddy Dave Feldman. Some people go low carb. Some people see a dramatic increase in LDL. Some people will see a very dramatic increase in LDL. We call these people lean mass hyper-responders. And you'll see in the next slide here that the lean mass hyper-responder phenotype generally has very high HDL cholesterol. Mine is between 80 and 110, a very high LDL cholesterol, and pretty low triglycerides. So these are all what Dave would call the triad. This doesn't seem to behave the same way with an elevated LDL as what you would see in someone with diabetes who has low HDL, high triglycerides, markers of insulin resistance. This is kind of Dave's slide again. He's at Cholesterol Code, and you can see that he has characterized lean mass hyperresponders as relatively low carb diets. I don't eat a lot of carbohydrates in my diet, a moderate amount, pretty low body fat stores, pretty lean, and a lot of activity and athletic demand. Yes, that's me. I work out a lot. And generally, this is what we see. HDL above 80, mine is above 80, triglycerides below 70, mine are usually below 70. I do think eating a bunch of honey pushed it up a little bit, and I'm going to do a new experiment without honey in my diet, and I think my triglycerides will be lower. And my LDL is much higher than 200 milligrams per deciliter. So in this situation, the question then becomes, can we think about context? Is this the same thing that's happening in so many of the studies that so often get cited with LDL? I would argue, no, it's not. Again, I want to show you what context matters for LDL, Lp(a), ApoE4, uric acid. You can refer back to their gout video. So let's start with the graphics from Joe Rogan that I showed on the Joe Rogan Experience podcast. Again, these are all the show notes. Heartandsoil.co/Rogan will get you to this page, the JRE show notes. And as you can see, if you look at the Framingham study, if you look at the risk stratification by HDL, what you will see is that the increasing relative risk of coronary artery disease on the y-axis versus the LDL level on the y-axis, HDL clearly matters. And HDL is a proxy for metabolic health or dysfunction, with the lowest levels of HDL being associated with insulin resistance and the highest levels being associated with insulin sensitivity or metabolic health. So what I'm saying here is that the relative risk of coronary artery disease in this Framingham study cohort, this is epidemiology, but when you stratify the Framingham cohort by HDL, you see a very different risk of coronary artery disease when you introduce any variable, whether it's HDL or fasting insulin or triglycerides, all of which I will show you studies with in this mini podcast. The risk of coronary artery disease is totally different than the overall correlation between LDL and cardiovascular disease, which you can see here, which is what is always shown to you. So this is exactly the same data in this graphic and this graphic that I have stratified by HDL levels. Context matters, my friends. Context matters in a big, big way. LDL does not cause atherosclerosis de novo. I'm not saying that LDL is not involved in the atherosclerotic plaque. And in fact, a subset of LDL called Lp(a) probably is very involved in the atherosclerotic plaque. Is it possible that in the setting of metabolic dysfunction, if you have more LDL around, that could look worse? Yeah. But also, is it possible that having a lot of LDL around without metabolic dysfunction to spark the fire could be helpful or not harmful at all, because LDL itself doesn't initiate atherosclerosis? This is the point that I'm trying to argue and show data for this. Now, there are many people that disagree with me, and I'll debate them all in good time. But the context here that we're thinking about is this. And I have shown this study multiple times, but I want to emphasize it here again. The prevalence of optimal metabolic health in American adults, this is the National Health and Nutritional Examination Survey. And you can see here, the prevalence of metabolic health in American adults is alarmingly low, even in normal weight individuals. The large number of people not achieving optimal health levels of risk factors, even in low risk groups, has serious implications for public health. What they say here, 12.2% is the proportion of metabolically healthy Americans. 12.2%, which means 88% of Americans are metabolically unhealthy or meet one of the guidelines up here, right? A waist circumference greater than 102 or 88 for men and women centimeters, a fasting glucose greater than 100, a hemoglobin A1C greater than 5.7, systolic blood pressure greater than 120 millimeters of mercury, or a diastolic blood pressure greater than 80 millimeters of mercury, or triglycerides greater than 150, or HDL less than 40 or 50 for men and women respectively. Many of the exact same metrics that I would substratify LDL versus cardiovascular disease comparisons by, just like I showed you with Framingham data, when you introduce one metric that suggests there is metabolic health or unhealth, you see massive differences in the risk of cardiovascular disease by LDL. But these are not the only studies that show this. I want to show you more. Before I move on to that, I just want to show a couple of studies that really enforce or reinforce this concept of, number one, HDL as an insulin-resistant state or as a proxy of metabolic dysfunction. So isolated low HDL cholesterol, an insulin-resistant state. This is really well known. Insulin levels during an oral glucose tolerance test were significantly higher in the low HDL group than in the control group. It's a pretty clear indication of metabolic unhealth, metabolic dysfunction in that group. If you have an isolated low HDL, not always, sometimes it's genetic, but often it's an indication of metabolic unhealth, metabolic dysfunction. Again, this is the context that I'm trying to put all of this into. We cannot conflate elevated LDL in someone that's metabolically healthy with someone who is metabolically unwell. Insulin resistance predicts severity of coronary atherosclerosis disease in non-diabetic patients. So conclusion here, insulin resistance goes hand in hand with the extension and severity of coronary atherosclerosis in non-diabetic patients. They use something called the HOMA-IR, which is a calculated score, which takes into account fasting insulin and fasting glucose. The point here is that insulin resistance determines the severity of atherosclerosis or the progression of it. Now, if LDL itself were enough to initiate atherosclerosis, why would we see this connection? Context matters. Now, let's get on to some of these other studies with LDL that are super interesting. This is a great one from Quebec, which is one that I was really looking for a long time. It's directly comparing insulin levels and using insulin levels to stratify the connection between LDL and cardiovascular disease. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine in 1996. You can see high fasting insulin concentrations appear to be an independent predictor of ischemic heart disease in men. Logistic regression analysis showed the insulin concentration remained associated with ischemic heart disease, with an odds ratio for ischemic heart disease with each one standard deviation in the insulin concentration of 1.7. And I'll show you the graphic, which really makes this quite clear. You'll see the odds ratio for ischemic heart disease on the y-axis here, fasting insulin across the x-axis. Look at the fasting insulins they chose. The lowest tertile was less than 12. Less than 12 is not a fasting insulin that's healthy. That's ridiculous. I want to see somebody less than 5. They probably couldn't even find enough people that had a fasting insulin of less than 12 to put in this group. But you'll see, nevertheless, whether your triglycerides are low or high, your odds ratio of having ischemic heart disease was very low with a low fasting insulin. Let's look at ApoB down here. This is essentially LDL. Whether your ApoB is low or high, and your fasting insulin is low, you have a much lower odds ratio of having ischemic heart disease with a low fasting insulin. Context matters. Context matters. Now, this is to me so crystal clear. LDL itself is not the determiner of atherosclerosis. If it were, then whether you had an insulin that was high or low, with a high ApoB, you would see the same progression of atherosclerosis. There is a third variable. In fact, there is a huge contextual importance to all of this. Metabolic health determines the atherogenicity of your lipid profile. If you're metabolically healthy and you got a high LDL in the process of becoming metabolically healthy, I don't believe that's a problem at all. Again, remember, my coronary artery calcium score is zero. So then the question becomes, why does LDL rise so much if you're eating a diet like mine? There are many suspicions. I'll be talking to many people about this in the future in debates. I think that the most compelling hypothesis is that it has something to do with the saturated fat to polyunsaturated fat ratio. And the higher saturated fat, lower polyunsaturated fat ratio leads to a decrease in LDL receptors, which leads to an increase in LDL. That sounds bad at first until you realize that the reason you put more LDL receptors on the liver when you eat more polyunsaturated fat is probably to pull out all of the oxidized LDL, which is really the same as LP little a, lipoprotein little a. So we know, and I've shown this multiple times, if you decrease saturated fat and increase polyunsaturated fat, your LP little a goes up. Your oxidized LDL goes up. This is very bad. We also know that native LDL, non-oxidized LDL, doesn't get retained in the subintimal space. Do you want to do something in your life that increases your oxidized LDL and or LP little a? Again, those are probably synonymous. The reason the LDL is going up if you're eating more saturated fat and less polyunsaturated fat may be because you don't have as much oxidized LDL and you don't need as many LDL receptors on the liver to pull it out of circulation. Now, wouldn't that be ironic or very interesting and a really fascinating twist to this whole conundrum? So a couple more from this Quebec study, they looked at the same markers. They looked at HDL. So the first one I showed you was them looking at fasting insulin, but here they're looking at HDL as a marker of coronary heart disease risk in the Quebec study. They found the exact same things as the Framingham study. They found a low HDL cholesterol concentration is not often observed as an isolated disorder, but also includes hypertriglyceridemia. In addition, a reduced plasma HDL was found to have a greater impact than raised LDL cholesterol on the atherogenic index. This ratio being the best variable of the traditional lipid profile for the prediction of ischemic heart disease events in the Quebec cardiovascular study. So again, what we're saying here, context matters. Low HDL is indicative of underlying metabolic dysfunction. And when you have underlying metabolic dysfunction, your relative risk of IHD goes way up. Look at HDL. This is essentially the same data, type of data that's presented in the Framingham study that I showed you in the beginning. The relative risk of ischemic heart disease on the y-axis, the HDL cholesterol on this x-axis, and LDL cholesterol on what we might call the z-axis. You can see that there's three tertiles here for HDL and for LDL. If you have the lowest LDL and the highest HDL, the lowest HDL, the highest LDL, you have a pretty darn high risk of ischemic heart disease. But let's reverse that. Let's go to somewhere like I might be, a high LDL and a very high HDL. Well, the risk is significantly lower. What if you have a low LDL and a high HDL? Well, that's the lowest risk of all of them. But you can see here that the ratio and the amount of HDL cholesterol indicative of underlying metabolic dysfunction is clearly a determinant here of the amount of ischemic heart disease. There is a context involved. None of these are perfect. They're epidemiology studies, but there is a third variable. And we cannot ignore this. If LDL were causing atherosclerosis by itself, we wouldn't see this. Now, LP little a is something I mentioned previously. Oxidized LDL and LP little a are pretty similar. And people think of LP little a as such a horrible, horrible thing. But when you look at studies of LP little a, you start to see the same context develop. Modulation of LP little a atherogenicity by high density lipoprotein cholesterol levels in middle-aged men with symptomatic coronary artery disease and normal to moderately elevated serum cholesterol. You'll see here, this is a double-blind, placebo-controlled, quantitative angiographic study that assessed the effect of 2 years of pravastatin, which is a statin. Pravastatin did not affect serum apolipoprotein little a levels, but in patients with an in-trial HDL cholesterol levels less than 0.7 millimole per liter, LP little a predicted up to 37% of arteriographic changes, but not in those who had higher HDL. So what they're saying is that there's modulation of LP little a atherogenicity by HDL cholesterol levels, which again are a proxy for, say it with me, metabolic health, which is what I've been saying the whole time. This is what I've been saying the entire time, okay? One more with LP little a. So you can see here, oxidized phospholipids, LP delay, LPPLA2, 10-year cardiovascular outcomes. If you look at this graph, you can see that the oxidized phospholipids ApoB tertiles and LPPLA2 tertiles clearly determine how bad LP little a levels are. Oxidized phospholipids ApoB is essentially the same as LP little a, not to be confused with LPPLA2, which is lipoprotein phospholipase A2. So these are not the same thing. LPPLA2 is an enzyme that cleaves off oxidized phospholipids. Oxidized phospholipids on ApoB is essentially LP little a. The point of these graphics, and you can look at here at the Framingham 10-year risk estimate, clearly, depending on your Framingham risk, no matter what oxidized phospholipids on ApoB tertile or LP little a tertile you're in, you have a lower risk if your overall Framingham risk is lower. This is the same thing here with your LPPLA2. If you have, there's a contextual variable further affecting LP little a. That's the point I'm trying to make here. Just like LDL, LP little a is affected by the context, the underlying metabolic health context. So I always try and make these videos short. They always end up being longer than I think, but I want to rip through the rest of this and then I'll wrap it up. I want to show you guys some stuff outside of the realm of LDL. I did a video on gout. All of the videos are at heartandsoil.co under the videos tab. And I talked about how uric acid is not a problem unless you're metabolically unwell. So this is from a study that I'll show you the title of in a moment. And they mention multiple studies looking at 42 obese patients, 16 patients in Ramadan who were fasting, having increased uric acid. None of the patients developed gout. So uric acid rising in the setting of fasting is not the same as uric acid that rises in the setting of metabolic dysfunction. Again, context matters. If context mattered for LDL and LP little a, why wouldn't it matter for things like uric acid, ApoB, all these things? This is the same question I get all the time. What about ApoE4? ApoE4, I believe, is only a problem if you're metabolically unhealthy. Did a whole podcast on that with Tommy Wood. All the podcasts, heartandsoil.co in the podcast. This is just a short-term intermittent fasting for weight loss case report. And to really drive this point home, I want to share a few of the studies that I have talked about multiple times in the past, looking at ApoE4 in metabolically healthy individuals in the Samane and the Bolivian Yoruba. So here is ApoE4 in Nigeria. Oh, the Nigerian Yoruba, cholesterol, ApoE4 genotype, Alzheimer's disease. What they found was that those who had the ApoE4 genotype were protected. They had the lowest rates of Alzheimer's disease if you had ApoE4. There's a significant interaction between cholesterol, ApoE4, and risk of Alzheimer's. A population that has a lower cholesterol levels, lower incidence rates of Alzheimer's disease compared to African Americans. Here you go. Increasing levels of cholesterol were associated with increasing risk of Alzheimer's disease in individuals without the ApoE4 allele, but not in those with the ApoE4 allele. Furthermore, they found that logistic regression models showed interaction after adjustment for age and gender between ApoE4 genotype and biomarkers in the risk of Alzheimer's disease, cholesterol. What they found essentially was that if you had ApoE4, you had a lower risk of developing dementia. Isn't that interesting, especially when it's Alzheimer's? Again, these are population in Nigeria that are pretty metabolically healthy. In the Samane, ApoE4 is associated with improved cognitive function in Amazonian forager horticulturists with a high parasite burden. Now, again, same findings. Older adult E4 carriers with higher parasite burdens either maintained or showed slight improvements in cognitive performance, whereas non-E4 carriers with a high parasite burden showed reduced cognitive performance. Being an E4 carrier is the strongest risk factor of Alzheimer's disease to date and cognitive decline in the industrial population, that is the metabolically unhealthy population. It's associated with greater cognitive performance in individuals facing a high parasite and pathogen load who are metabolically healthy. So If you've heard me talk about APOE4 before, you will know that APOE4 is the ancestral genotype. We've had APOE4 throughout the entirety of our human evolution, and APOE3 and APOE2 only developed in the last couple hundred thousand years. So throughout our whole evolution, APOE4 has probably been protective, but there's a strong argument that those who are metabolically healthy do not have problems with APOE4. It's, again, the risk of APOE4 is modulated by the underlying metabolic health. So context is everything. Is my elevated, quote, LDL on a carnivore diet, as I'm a lean mass hyper responder with lean mass, I'm a fairly lean individual, if you've seen pictures of me, and high HDL, low triglycerides, is that going to give me the same ischemic heart disease risk as somebody who has a high LDL, but metabolic dysfunction, metabolic dyslipidemia, who has a completely different context? I say no. And this is what we're arguing, that I'm eating essentially an ancestrally consistent diet. Why would this increase my risk of heart disease? If you are having the same changes, we need to be asking the same questions. If your LDL doesn't change on a carnivore diet, carnivore-ish diet, ketogenic diet, nobody's going to even raise an eyebrow because the rest of your markers are going to look fine. You're going to feel freaking great. But LDL has become the sharp end of the spear because it's often the sticking point. People will go to their doctor and they'll say, I feel amazing. I've lost all this weight. My autoimmune disease has gotten better. And my LDL is through the roof. Well, you have to stop doing that because you're going to get heart disease. I think that's bullshit. And we are debating this repeatedly. We're just examining these ideas. So hopefully this is helpful. Check us out at heartandsoil.co if you guys need more nose to tail nutrition in your life. We've got all kinds of good stuff there. If you can get the fresh organs, that's fantastic. We make the best desiccated organs on the planet. Again, the show notes for Joe Rogan, heartandsoil.co/Rogan. Thank you for being a part of the remembering. Thank you for support of this work. Let me know what you think of this. As always, you can email me, Dr. Paul, drpaul@heartandsoil.co. If you have product recommendation questions, or if you have dietary questions, I cannot answer lab questions. I can't be your doctor over email. But if you have specific questions about carnivore diet, how to get more organs, the products we make, and you think it's appropriate, shoot me an email. I would love to help you. Stay radical, you guys. Thank you all.